Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. But before we get started, I have an important announcement to make. So I've grepped through the remaining packages in the big master list of Slackware packages, and there are about 520 remaining, maybe 510 after the previous episode. So I figure if I cover 10 packages each episode, that means there are about 51 episodes, until I reach the end of all Slackware packages. Let's just say 52 episodes from this point. So I've decided that when I reach that point, when I go to the Slackware server and there are no further packages to cover, then I'm going to stop producing the GNU World Order podcast. I don't take the end of a podcast lightly, and that's why I'm announcing my intention right now, a full year before it happens. The way I podcast, honestly, it doesn't take that much time to produce an episode, and you can probably hear that in the overall quality of my shows. It's not something that I take a lot of time on. And I mean, frankly, the research I do for the show is a lot of fun, and it's something I'd more or less be doing anyway. However, podcasting does take some time, and because of its episodic nature, it focuses my attention on certain topics or some topic I can bring to the microphone and discuss. And having experienced that for about a decade now, I feel like it's probably time for me to remove that focus and do a little exploring, specifically into programming and distribution maintenance. The way I kind of do a lot of the things that I do right now, and maybe this is worth an episode at some point, I don't know if it's worth it, but the one of the principles that I have is basically, you know, to spend 10 minutes on each thing, a bare minimum 10 minutes on anything that I want to do during the day or in general. So if I target, well, I want to be better at programming in some language, then at the very least, I'm going to program for 10 minutes in that language every day, like every single day. And you think 10 minutes is not enough to do anything. And that is true. It is not enough to do anything. But 10 minutes spread over 365 days is 3,650 minutes, which if you divide that by some number, you get some bigger number or smaller number rather. Anyway, it's a number of hours spent a year on that task. And that it goes for anything. It goes for programming. It goes for painting little miniatures for tabletop games. It goes for playing tabletop games. It goes for basically everything. It's 10 minutes at the very least. Sometimes it's more. It is never less. So that's kind of like a principle that I have in helping me focus on something that I want to learn about. But I want to do more programming. I want to be better at, for instance, building a DevOps style system to help myself contribute actual commits to open source projects, whether those commits are corrections to config files or code or anything else. So in other words, I want the flexibility to be able to decide that today I'm going to spend several hours programming rather than, you know, 10 minutes or an hour or whatever it might end up being. I need the flexibility in my schedule to just block out big chunks of time to do a specific thing that I'm trying to get better at. And part of me thinks, well, I could do that and then podcast about it. That would make for good content, maybe, except it actually doesn't. There is a lot of grunt work that just doesn't make for an easy podcast series, or at least anything that would be interesting to listen to. And to be fair, I may well find that recording my thoughts in a very sort of casual way might become a podcast someplace, just a general geeky topic podcast, which would combine gaming and Linux and a bunch of other topics, you know, essentially anything that I wanted to talk about in a completely unstructured way. Who knows? Maybe that'll happen, but maybe not, because again, I find that I don't want to force myself to focus on media production, such as it is, when there are other things that I also want to get done during the day or the week. And so I think eventually, like maybe as I become more comfortable with certain activities and I'm able to distill them down into demonstrable and explainable things, maybe it could be a series of some sort. But for now, I need to step outside the structured presentation, if I dare call GNU World Order structured, so I can find my way around some new disciplines, some new skills, and so on. So that's the plan anyway. I hate announcing things too far in advance because plans and circumstances do have a habit of changing. But for now, it is my intent to stop production in roughly 52 episodes from this point, but at one episode a week, that's a whole year away, and there are lots of packages to cover. So let's talk first about KRB5. This is in the networking category, as we have been in the N section, and this is KRB5. KRB5 is Kerberos 5. I use this every day at work. It's something I'm pretty well familiar with, but it deserves a proper explanation so that we all understand how it works, because it is complex and it's really, really clever. So first of all, Kerberos it's an authentication protocol, or really specifically, a single sign-on protocol. So this is, you can think of it a little bit, common comparisons are PGP and even OpenSSL, but for reasons that you will understand very soon, it's not like those. I mean, otherwise, we would just use those. But if you think of that kind of principle of like, oh, keys are being exchanged, there's encryption involved, that's what Kerberos does. And Kerberos ensures, essentially, that like OpenSSL, you can recognize a server, and that server can recognize you, and then very, very significantly, traffic between you and a resource online, a service online, can be encrypted with keys that only you and the server know. Here's how it works. First of all, there are some key terminologies that you should know if you're going to go delving into Kerberos. It's not necessarily something that, you know, there are definitely words for these that we could use, but I mean, this is what Kerberos uses. So if you're going to go read up on it or set up a server, an authentication server, or a KDC really, then you should know these concepts. So a user, for whatever reason, they're not called a user in Kerberos, they're called a principal. Okay, cool, great. A key distribution center is really the Kerberos server. Like, that's the thing that's managing all of the, or, well, I don't want to sum it up too tritely. So that's the Kerberos server. Like, when you set up Kerberos, you are setting up a key distribution center, or a KDC. I'm going to be saying KDC a lot because really that's what you see in the documentation a lot of. So that's kind of the gatekeeper. That's the thing making sure that people who don't have any business signing in are not able to sign in. Now, the KDC offers two different services. There's the authentication service, and there's the ticket granting service, or TGS sometimes, but ticket granting service is how I'll refer to it, and then the authentication service. And then we're going to call the other component a resource. And that's the server that the principal, the user, wants to access. So let's just say that there's a server out there with some files that you need, but you know that it is protected by some kind of authentication process or a single sign-on process. And so how do you use Kerberos to help with this process? How do you, the principal, get to the resource that you want to see on the internet? Well, here's how it all works. So the principal, that's the user, authenticates with a username and a password to the key distribution center, so to Kerberos. So someone has entered you into this system. So this is not like OpenSSL. Someone has entered your user account into this system, into the Kerberos distribution center. Now, maybe that was literally a sysadmin being told by their superior, hey, I need you to add this new hire to Kerberos. Maybe it was a script that someone fired off. Or maybe it was something online that has encouraged you to sign up with their service. And part of that process, whether you know it or not, is to create some Kerberos credentials. And that would consist of a username and a password. So to you, you're just creating any old username and a password. But what you're actually doing is you're signing into a Kerberos Distribution Center server and creating an account there. Okay, so the authentication service that's on the Kerberos, the KDC, generates a ticket granting ticket, which gives you permission to get a different ticket so that you can access the resource. All right, so now you have from the KDC a ticket granting ticket, a ticket that gives you permission to get another ticket. So a ticket granting ticket is delivered to the principal, and very importantly, the ticket granting service also gets a copy of this ticket granting ticket. Now remember, the ticket granting service is another sort of, it's another side of the KDC. There's the authentication server and there's the ticket granting service. That's what the KDC does. So the KDC lets you sign on to the authentication service, verifies your identity with the username and password, and then it gives you the ticket granting ticket. It also gives the ticket granting service a copy of the same ticket granting ticket. So you both have a copy of this ticket now. Now, you, the principal, you submit your ticket granting ticket to the ticket granting service. The ticket granting service compares the thing that you've just given it to the one that it received from the authentication service. See, now, the ticket granting service is verifying that you have a thing that only an authenticated user could possibly have. So as long as your ticket granting ticket matches the ticket granting ticket that the ticket granting service got from the authentication server, then it can be safely assumed that you are the person who got blessed by the authentication service. Okay, so now, assuming they match, the ticket granting service generates a service ticket. This is the big one. This is your service ticket. It's encrypted with a secret key, or in some cases, a symmetrical key, and there are reasons that one might be used over the other. You can find out more on the Kerberos documentation. I'll reference the thing to read in a moment. But there's this encrypted ticket that you have, a service ticket now. So this is your key to access your destination resource, the thing that you actually want to look at, the file server or whatever it is that you're trying to get into. Now, the file server gets the corresponding key that decrypts your service ticket. It gets that pre-shared with it from the KDC. And so when you approach your destination resource with this special encrypted key, your destination resource can decrypt your key because it's a valid key and it has the other half of that key. And so the authentication process is successful. Just like PGP, really, it's pre-shared key stuff. Now, this is a timed authentication, so this will work for you across all resources that have this pre-shared key to decrypt your service ticket. That'll work for you for probably a couple of hours. That's usually the time allowed by Kerberos. I mean, the admin could change it based on the requirements, but that's the usual use case for this. And that's why if you go into a system with single sign-on, very frequently, it'll last all day, like a good 8 hours. You'll be able to keep signing into that site as if though you were already authenticated. And the reason for that is because you got a copy of that service ticket. It's in your system now. And there are tools in the KRB5 package that can show that to you. Specifically, it's the klist command, which is part of the KRB5 package. And it is designed to list all Kerberos credentials in your little Kerberos key ring that you currently have. If you have nothing, you can still just type klist and you'll get a message that you have nothing in your key ring currently. But if you do have something in your key ring, then it displays that. Kerberos typically happens rather invisibly through your web browser. I mean, that's the most common use case probably. You go to a website or some kind of sign-in portal. You give your username and your password, and all of that stuff that I've just described, these passing over of various authentication credentials, that happens in the background. And maybe if you're a very observant user, you notice like that the the web browser loads to a, you know, some kind of authentication URL that you don't recognize, but quickly thereafter it goes straight into the resource that you're actually signing into. So that's how it usually works. But you can trigger Kerberos in some cases with the kinit command. The kinit command simply probes or pokes the authentication, or the KDC rather, well, and, you know, initially the authentication service of the KDC, it pokes that to for you to authenticate. So usually what I do is I do kinit, for instance, klatu at id.example.com, let's say. And that would be the name, id.example.com would be the name of the security realm that the KDC has set up. Now, I would need access to that KDC. And if it's for work or something, you might have to be on the VPN in order to even gain, you know, literal access to that server. Like, you may not have access to that. It might not be outwardly facing. So potentially you might have to do that, you know, within a VPN. But there are other places like Fedora Project, the Fedora Project, in order to put packages up on their package build service, you can use kinit to authenticate, so that you're now building and you know, running build services or package builds on their build service, and that uses kinit, or you can use kinit. So kinit is really useful. I use kinit every morning. I sign on to my VPN. And then the VPN that my employer has, I sign into that, and then I use kinit right away to authenticate, to give my Kerberos credentials to the KDC, and that stores a token on my system. And then whenever I go to open a web browser to go to a site for which I need a sign-on credential then it just loads. I don't have to put in usernames and passwords and tokens and things like that. I'm just on the system now because I've got that KDC, or rather that authentication token, that ticket rather, the service ticket from KDC. I've already authenticated. I don't have to go through that in my web browser. And because it is single sign-on, all of the servers on that network, they're all being given the pre-shared, the key that they need to decrypt my service ticket. And that's why it is a single sign-on, because you get your service ticket from KDC once, and then all the servers, all the services on that network that are using the KDC infrastructure, they already have what they need in order to trust that you are who you say you are. There are a bunch of safeguards set up around Kerberos. I mean, some built into the design of the technology and some best practices. For instance, you wouldn't want your KDC to be literally just one KDC. You wouldn't want one Kerberos server, which, you know, that manages all the tickets and does all of that itself, because that would be a single point of failure. And if that one thing goes down, then your entire network is unreachable, or rather is unauthenticatable too. But for a full overview of Kerberos, and it is an interesting, it's a fascinating system, you know, like going through it, you think, oh, this seems over complex. Like, why am I just sending a ticket to a thing to get a ticket to get a ticket? But, I mean, it works. I mean, if you step through it, it makes sense. Go to web.mit.edu/kerberos/papers.html. There's a bunch of resources there that you can read up on, including one called, I don't know if this deserves its title, to be honest, but it is entitled, what is it? Kerberos for Morons. And I mean, when you name your thing Kerberos for Morons, or a Moron's Guide to Kerberos, you'd better be prepared, I think, to be really, really clear about what you're talking about. And I don't know that this paper, brief though it may be, I don't know if it quite lives up to its name. I feel like this is still pretty complex stuff. But it's not a bad paper. You should definitely read that one if you're looking for more information about kind of like just an overview of the system. And I think that's the part that it does the least good part of, giving an overview of the thing like I just did, giving you a step by step. I don't really feel like it does that, but it does talk a lot about the peripheral concerns around Kerberos, like the simple matter of needing to use a network time protocol to ensure, you know, that repeated requests aren't used as an attack. So yeah, there are some interesting things that they do to mitigate and to kind of bolster Kerberos's really reliability that is definitely worth a read. Okay, so there are actually more packages in KRB5 than just what I've talked about. I've only mentioned KList and KInit. There are others. There's like KPassword and KRB5-config and KSwitch and KTutil and a bunch of other things. They're useful. Most of them, I think, like kadmin, I mean, they're really kind of geared towards the administrator doing, doing the setup tasks. And all of that is interesting and it's important, but I'm not going to go into it. I think the overview of Kerberos is the more important component here. A lot of the other commands in this package, I think one tends to discover them as one becomes in, you know, when you need them, that's when you start to really discover those, because otherwise you're not going to be using kadmin. Typically, you're, at least as a user, you're going to be using, if anything, kinit and klist to get the credentials. But yeah, if you're adminning a Kerberos server, then you're going to discover things like kadmin when you need to manipulate or review the database, the Kerberos database, and the other commands, you know, based on the need. It's a little bit like Samba. Setting it up is one thing, and then maintaining it with all the different commands is another, and you typically are going to be doing, you know, the setup, and ideally everything is just going to work, and then you discover all of those other commands as you continue to maintain it and discover a need for more advanced tasks. That's Kerberos. That's everything that I can think of really to talk about Kerberos in a meaningful way. So let's move on to getting coffee, because honestly, that's where we are in this episode. We need a cup of coffee after all that. Let's do that. We'll come back and finish up the show. Okay, I'm back. I have coffee. Hopefully you do too. I have listener feedback. So Blind Ape on Mastodon says, "Hey Klaatu, I'm currently listening to GNU World Order 562 and have a similar relationship with chat these days. I used to be more involved in different communities, but while I have signed up to several Matrix feeds, I never really read them or take part in the conversations. It may be due to New Zealand's time zone being out of sync with the rest of the world, but that didn't stop me 10 to 15 years ago. Also, do you have the link to the Bash cheat sheet you mentioned a couple of episodes earlier?" So I'll take those in two steps. First, no, I don't think I have that Bash cheat sheet. I've kind of fallen out of using cheat sheets lately. I don't know why. Maybe I've just settled into sort of habitual commands and I've just not needed to go outside of them. But yeah, right now I haven't really used cheat sheets in a while. I mean, normally I use cheat sheets all the time. I find them invaluable. I cannot tell you. I mean, Git, I learned Git but by maintaining a cheat sheet just to the left of my keyboard. I was always writing things down and always referring back to them. It was invaluable. Same thing with Emacs, did the same thing. So and Python and Lua, I mean, that's how I keep sort of information, really, is on like a notepad just next to my keyboard. But lately, I guess I just haven't been doing things that require that. I'm not at all saying that there's never anything I'm going to do in the future that will require that. I'm actually anticipating quite the opposite. But for now, I haven't used cheat sheets in a while. And then what was the other question? Oh yeah, the chat. Yeah, I'm not going to say chat. Chat for me right now, and I apparently for some other people, is just not fitting into the workflow. And I don't know exactly why. I do think that there's something to kind of the quality of the internet. And that's not a slander against people using chat. I'm just saying I don't know that there's as much to talk about the internet. as there used to be. I remember, at least in my chats, you know, we would talk about setting services up and configuring and maintaining things. And in a weird way, I kind of feel like a bunch of the services that you can set up now don't require that much maintenance and configuration, which is a good thing. Like, that's great. And then in another way, just there's so much out there now that's being sort of owned and dominated by some major sort of corporate group that it's just kind of not as fun to talk about it anymore, because it's just kind of like not really your thing. It's their thing. I don't know. There's something to that. And I don't know what that is. And maybe that has nothing to do with it. I'm just saying that, I feel like there was a certain quality of things are still being built, let's talk about them, that now, whether it's a bad or a good thing, or a little bit of both, more likely, there's just a lot that's kind of settled. It's like, we've built a bunch of the infrastructure. Things exist now. You can have your own video chat service. You can have your own collaborative spreadsheet online. You know, there's so many things that you can just kind of make happen with YouKnowHost or Nextcloud or all these other things. It's just kind of like, we're done. Like, I did that one-click install, and not a whole lot to talk about. So I don't know. But, you know, I mean, there's other stuff in life to talk about too. So I'm kind of approaching this assuming, we want to talk about Linux. We want to talk about open source. What about just talking about gaming or something? And even that, I haven't really been, it's just not a part of my workflow lately. And again, like with my cheat sheets, not saying that it's never going to be part of my workflow, but right now it just doesn't quite fit in. And I'm not 100% sure why. There's probably lots of different reasons. Just things like, just like literally the physical layout of my house, you know? I mean, it's different, you know? I'm not sitting in a coffee shop for 8 hours now. I used to do that. I would go to a coffee shop and sit from open to close, and that's where I would be the entire day. And when you're doing that, sometimes it's like, you know what, I wouldn't mind having that chat window just kind of hovering off in the corner and getting back to it here and there just as a distraction, you know? So maybe it's as simple as that. It's probably as simple as that. Next feedback is from BJB, says, learning IP tables, I would use IP tables -j log to start instead of -j drop. I agree the tutorials could be better, and this is one way they could start. Yeah, that's a really good point. That never occurred to me. That's a great, really good point. -j log, it doesn't, it's kind of like SE Linux what is it called? Permissive mode or something like that? Is that what it's called? Jeez, I don't even remember. You know, it's kind of like, we're not changing anything, but we are taking note of everything that is happening. And then you can learn from just the recording of what's been happening. And another great comment from BJB, to get a list of devices, of network devices, without your IP address being listed, it's IP link list, IP space link space list. Or, as BJB points out, you can do a lot of really shortened versions of these commands, which I don't think I actually mentioned in the show. And I don't know why I didn't mention it, because that's very frequently how I use them. I guess I prefer like talking about the things that are sort of self-documenting. So IP link list is a lot easier to understand than the potential alternative, which is IP space L space L. And you can carry that over into the other commands like the, you know, IP adder or address show. You can just do IP space A for address space S for show. IP space A space S, and it runs that command. It's kind of beautiful. I mean, it really is really nice. I can't tell you how often I use IP space A space S over IP adder show or address show. It's kind of nice. It's a weird sort of like halfway between like, why aren't you just making an alias for yourself? If you do it that often, like, why don't you just make an alias and make it short? But it's really convenient, because it's like, well, you don't have to make an alias. It's just, it's really, really that simple. Just a couple of letters. I think it's the spaces, bizarrely, that annoy me. I almost feel it's just so funny how you get sort of privileged about commands after a while. It's just like, IP space A space S. That's so many spaces for so few letters. It just seems excessive. It's like, yeah, but it's drastically fewer letters than IP space ADDRESS space SHOW. So like, what are you complaining about? And I don't know. It's just, again, it comes down to like that, the flow, the workflow of, well, when I type, I don't like, it doesn't feel natural to hit the space after just a single letter. Especially after two single letters, it just feels weird. Whereas typing out a whole word and then a space, that feels more normal to me. I don't know. It's neither here nor there, really. The thing is that there are really nice abbreviations for the IP command if you want. And, oh, I forgot. BJB also points out that if config still does exist, which, I mean, I know it still exists, whether or not it's supposed to be, whether it's supposed to exist or not. So here's what BJB says. If config still exists, I've heard it has been re-implemented with IP route 2 internals so that those who have if config burned immutably into their memory, that they don't have to learn, you know, a new thing. Also to avoid breaking automation. And that seems plausible. That's what BJB says, and this is Clat2 again. That does seem plausible to me. It seems realistic. I think breaking the automation thing is really, really important. Or not breaking automation. Really, really important. If config has been around for a long time, and I think that's eternally one of the sort of the questions I frequently have, you know, like if a command is sort of like deprecated for whatever reason, like, oh, this is no longer a useful command, or, oh, the person who used to maintain this command is no longer maintaining it and we don't have access to the repo, then like, what's the right call? You know, like, do you do if config dash ng, is that the new package name? And then you re-implement it, or do you just choose to say, well, the functionality of that command really makes sense in this bigger command, so we're going to roll it into a bigger command, despite the Unix philosophy, which we've talked about before, the ups and downs about around that. So what's the right way to supersede an existing command? And I don't know, it's a complex topic with lots of good arguments on lots of different sides, because the most obvious one is what BJB says, like, if you change the command from if config to IP space A space S, then all the scripts and all the things that assumed if config was a command are no longer functional. And you think, oh, come on, it doesn't happen that often. Yeah, but it's not supposed to ever happen. You know, like, we have commands from Unix dating back to the 70s, you know? So theoretically, like, that will still work. Sed still works, awk still works, you know, like these ancient commands, ls, cd, like they don't change. They're there forever. And I feel like it's weird, but I kind of feel like, yeah, once you create a command, we the community are kind of obligated to keep that command alive one way or the other, which I honestly don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a good thing. And then last but not least, BJB clarifies really, really expertly that MAC addresses implement networking as opposed to inter-networking, which would be the IP or the internet protocol layer. And that's super helpful to think about. And I mean, this is the kind of thing, if I had to hazard a guess, BJB probably has a Cisco certification or some such, some kind of certification, or has studied really, really well. This is super useful and super detailed information. And this is why those courses are actually really, really important, because you understand the distinctions between terms that we kind of take for granted, networking versus like an inter-network, a network of networks over an IP layer, that kind of thing. So that's very cool. Thank you very much, BJB, for the truly insightful comments. Those are great. Next up is LFTP. This is an FTP command, extremely flexible, the best FTP client, without question. And I say the best meaning it's the best if you're looking for an FTP client that is extremely flexible. Granted, like if you're looking for an FTP client that's a window, a graphical drag and drop type stuff, the LFTP is not that. It is a command, but it can be as interactive or non-interactive as you want. I used to use LFTP to post GNU World Order episodes, believe it or not. I mean, this is a long time ago now. But one nice thing about LFTP is that it isn't, even though it's called LFTP, it can do SFTP. It can do a bunch of protocols. I had a list of them and now I've clicked away from it, but a bunch of different protocols it can handle. So it's not just FTP. And as I say, the great thing is that it can be interactive or non-interactive. So you can use it just as an FTP client. You could do LFTP, FTP dot, what's a good open, FTP.freebsd.org. And then you're on FTP.freebsd.org. That's, you're there. You can, then you can do bash-like commands like ls or dir. Wait, dir is how you pronounce that letter. Dir, dir, or get, or put, and all the different FTP commands that you're used to, if you're used to FTP commands in 2024, which you may or may not be. But if you don't want to do that interactively, then you can do something like lftp space ftp.freebsd.org slash, because you're signing into the, what do they call it? The URL, not the site. So you want to treat this as a directory. So put the slash at the end and then space dash E for execute. And then in quotes, the command or commands that you want to execute. So in this case, it could be quote, get space index.html, close quote. You execute that and it all happens. You sign into the FTP server. This is an anonymous FTP server, so it doesn't require user and password. So you sign into the FTP server, and then once it's signed in, before, you know, you don't get a prompt or anything, it's just, it signs in and grabs the index.html file and places it in your current directory, and then it signs off. And that's it. Now you have a file from an FTP server. Or, you know, if you had permission to post to that server, you could do a put command instead, and so on. So it's a great little, easy to script, really easy to work with, very, very flexible. It is the best FTP command. Whether you need an FTP command in 2024 is, you know, I mean, it's up to you, I guess. I mean, some servers still run an FTP server, like the freebsd.org, the ftp.freebsd.org. That works. You can sign in today. You can look around. You can grab an image, probably. I didn't actually look any further than the main directory, but I mean, you know, it's there. That is a way to get things. LFTP can also do torrent downloads. So if you're looking for a torrent client, but you don't want something sort of big and that'll just kind of take up, you know, that kind of like is a thing, you just need a torrent download. LFTP can do that for you. You can use LFTP for it. So yeah, it's a really useful command to have around. It is just a command. It doesn't have a big interface, a GUI interface or anything like that. I mean, you know, in real life, I mean, I use KTorrent for torrents. I use SSH really for file transfer mostly, or SCP. So like in real life, no, I don't use LFTP all that much anymore, but it's kind of nice to know that it is there. It's super flexible. It can do lots of different sort of network communications, and it can do it interactively and non-interactively, which is really nice. So that's LFTP. Next up is libaswan. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I don't know if there is a correct way to say it. I didn't know much about this. Oh, I still don't know that much about it, but it's an inter-process communications library for GPG or GNUPG, GPGMe, and so on. And from its website, gnupg.org/software/libaswan, says, in an ideal world, Aswan is irrelevant. Aswan's primary use is to allow a client to interact with a non-persistent server. Using Aswan, this is accomplished by forking a sub-process and communicating with it over, for example, a pipe or Unix domain socket. This method is not elegant or efficient, especially when there's a lot of data spread across several transactions. Not only is there a penalty for an increased number of context switches, also a significant amount of data is memcopied from the client to a file descriptor and from the file descriptor to the server. But despite all of these disadvantages, this kind of communication can be useful. The client is completely separate from the server. They're in different address spaces, And that's important in situations where the server must have a known degree of reliability and data must be protected. As the S1 protocol is well-defined and clients cannot corrupt the server's address space, auditing becomes much easier. So it's a little bit of a buffer against essentially corrupted transactions. And that is as much as I know about that library. And so I'm going to move swiftly on to libgcrypt. This is another thing taken from GNU-PG. It is, I mean, it's really lifted from GNU-GP. It's a generic cryptography library based on the way GPG does its encryption. The thing is that it doesn't, you know, it's independent of GNU-PG. So you can take libgcrypt and use it in some other application and get a bunch of cryptography for yourself without invoking the entirety of libgpg or of GPG. Although it does rely on, or it does depend on libgpg-error, I think, which happens to be the next one in the list, libgpg-error. This is the library that defines common error values for all the GNU GPG, or rather GNU PG components. And that this also, you know, these error definitions are also true for libgcrypt. So you would need libgcrypt and libgpg-error in order to get a reliably usable cryptography sort of infrastructure. Next up is libksba, more commonly said libcasba or casbah. Libcasba is, again, a GNU GPG derived component. It is the library that sort of handles the X.509 certificate process and can provide that to you, you know, in your C program. The X509 protocol or standard really is an International Telecommunication Union, ITU, standard defining the format of public key certificates. So as you can imagine, GPG, which uses private and public keys, would play in that space quite a bit. And so libcasba is kind of the GNU PG implementation of ensuring X509 compliant keys are generated and can be managed easily. The next one is libimbim, which is not having to do anything with libgpg. In fact, it's got everything to do with mobile broadband modem devices. I very infrequently have ever, I'm not sure that I've ever used such a thing. Maybe I have. There might be some, you know, I don't know what protocol is being used. I did have a cell phone at one point for work that I could plug in, you know, through USB, and then I could tether to that device. So that might have been, I don't know, again, not really actually sure what protocol it was even using, but maybe that would have used the MBIM underpinnings. I'm not sure. But libmbim, important for mobile broadband modems. So if you've got one of those, you're probably using libmbim. Next in the list is libmilter. That's the a send mail filter API. So send mail or any email application or service on a computer at some point, whether it's in send mail or proc mail or, you know, whatever. I mean, this is specifically for send mail, so I guess I shouldn't be so broad about it. But generally speaking, send mail, it has to filter and sort of classify or process mail based on, like email, based on metadata or content or whatever you want to filter it by. So if you want to do that programmatically in your code, libmilter could be one way of doing that. libmnl is next, and this is a part of the netfilter project. Netfilters are sort of, well, it's the successor to IP tables, or rather NF tables are the successor of IP tables. So netfilter is just broadly the firewall and NAT and packet mangling service service for Linux. And it, so a lot of this happens, you know, within like Linux, traditionally speaking, like in the kernel. This is kernel stuff. And libmnl, I think, I've already forgotten, is, yeah, user space library oriented to Netlink developers, Netlink being a socket classification that the kernel uses to, or that something can use to do inter-process communication between user space and kernel stuff. So it's an important sort of line of communication, and libmnl along with lib, I think it's libnfnetlink, I think, yes, exactly that, libnfnetlink. These are libraries that assist either developers in the case of libmnl, or specifically people doing stuff with Netlink tools to have access to that line of communication and that kind of coordination required for inspecting packets or filtering packets, blocking, dropping packets, whatever. So that's libmnl. Don't know a whole lot about it, but as I say, I think the key takeaway there really is that netfilter is, when you hear IP tables on Linux today, you really ought to be thinking about netfilter. Like that's where everything is headed. Netfilter, NF tables, not IP tables. Which, in my view, like, that's a welcome change. I'm not sure, I haven't sat down and compared like side by side NF tables and IP tables, and which one's worse, which one's better. All I know is that I feel like IP tables, as I've said before, I don't mean to be down on it, but it just feels like it is one of those things that could use a bit of a shakeup, just a little bit. And I could be wrong. I could be absolutely wrong. I just said in this very episode that some commands should never change. So, maybe I am wrong. But I don't know. I think NF tables, certainly the tools around NF tables are really, really nice. And I just, in deep down, I just kind of feel like, yeah, I think I prefer that. Okay, so then I'm just going to knock out a bunch of libraries here and just say that there is a bunch of netfilter stuff. So libnetfilter account, libnetfilter contract, CT helper, law, C timeout, log, queue, and libnfnetlink, which I've already mentioned before. And then I think finally within this is the libnftnl, which is the user space interface for the kernel NF tables subsystem. And I may as well kind of quickly give an example or an overview of the NF table or the net filter subsystem, because it is, I keep saying, oh, it's different from IP tables, it's better. Is it better? I don't know. But it is different. Like I say, that feels kind of nice. There are lots of different ways to load an NF table into the system. IP tables, I always felt was a little bit weird how you loaded it in and made it. It was always hard, I feel like, to make IP tables, to figure out the state of your IP table. Like, is it persistent? Like, if I reboot, what's going to happen to my IP tables? I feel like that has always been kind of confusing to me. I'm not going to address that in the netfilter example, interestingly, because I don't have enough. I don't feel like I have enough real world experience with that to say definitively, oh, this is easier, this is clearer. I'm not sure. You can do a lot of scripting with this stuff. You can put it into nftables.rules and then load it at some point. You can write it into your load, your init. So I feel, reading about it, like it's a little bit clearer. But then again, there's a bunch of stuff you can do with IP tables too. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just, kind of sort of embracing the new thing that I didn't have to suffer through as a sysadmin, because it's new, it's different. Therefore, it must maybe be better. And that's obviously not necessarily true. Either way, the syntax is fascinating. So the first, you would open up your firewall process with a flush rule set. So that clears the table. And then you can create a table. So for instance, you might create a table called firewall. Table firewall open curly brace. Okay, already it's feeling a little bit more like code and less like just a list of things. So in this firewall, we're gonna have a chain for the incoming traffic. So chain space incoming. I don't know that I love the terminology of chain, but I think for people used to IP tables, it just does make sense. So I sympathize with that use. And frankly, I don't know what I would use otherwise, maybe. You know, maybe that is a perfectly acceptable term. So chain incoming open curly brace. So we're now two curly braces in. Type, filter, hook, input, priority zero, semicolon, policy drop, semicolon. Is that beautiful code? I wouldn't say so, no. But that's the setup. You're defining what we're dealing with and the policy, the default policy. Established connections you can define as CT state established, comma, related, accept. So if it's established connection, continue accepting that traffic. If name LO, so if the interface name is loopback LO, then accept. So I if name LO accept. What about ICMP? We talked about that in the previous episode or the episode before. I think, yeah, episode before. ICMP space type space echo dash request. You remember ICMP had a couple of different headers, you know, data in its headers, and one of them was an echo request. So if you want to accept that, then put accept. So ICMP type echo request, accept. And then for instance, TCP, dport, that's your destination port, semicolon, SS, not semicolon, curly brace, SSH, comma, HTTP, close curly brace, accept. So let out the SSH and the HTTP traffic, and then close curly brace. That was the entire, that's the chain, and that's the table. So that's really, really basic firewall. It's the one given on the NetFilter website, on their wiki, on their quote-unquote NF tables in 10 minutes article, which, I cannot imagine this teaching people NF tables in 10 minutes. It's completely indecipherable. This is the exact same problem I have with IP tables. And, frankly, I think the problem I have with it is that it's complex. And it's really, admittedly, like, this is a complex topic. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not critiquing it for being not good enough. I'm critiquing sort of like, I'm lamenting the fact that filtering traffic is truly a complex process. I don't envy the people who, or the projects that kind of have to tackle that, because it really is complex. Like, there's a lot to base your policies off of. And I don't know the right format to do that. I don't know that IP tables or NF tables is the perfect format for it, but I think both have done a lot to prove that they are serviceable formats. And so if you're going to learn it, you're going to learn one of these too. I do feel like NF tables would be the thing that I would pursue if I were doing sysadmin work today. I would gravitate towards that because, it's built into the kernel. It's the new thing. There's a lot of tooling around it that is pretty appealing. But, there's a lot of tooling around IP tables as well. So, half a dozen of one, six of the other. It's fine. It is complex, though. It's going to be something that is complex pretty much no matter what. And the sooner I can drop out of IP tables or NF tables and just use firewall CMD, the better. Like, honestly, that's my overall thought process. But obviously, some people at some levels of the stack, you don't have the luxury to just think, I'll use the simpler tool, because that's not the thing you're being asked to design. And for that, you do need something very, very complex, like IP tables or NF tables. And NetFilter is the built-in IP table successor. It is available as of Linux 3.13 or 3 dot something. So it's there. It's available to you. And you get some sense of how it operates from the sample code there. But really, these are the libraries that I'm talking about here. The libnetfilter, libnf so-and-so, like all of those libraries. They're the things that people are going to be using in their code to either innate, to write tools around NF tables or to utilize NF tables within their program, or to deal with that. So probably not something users are going to be thinking about very often, but you and I know that those libraries exist. They are in the in section of the Slackware package list, and that has not yet brought me to the end, darn it. There's one more that I forgot to mention. The lib, oh, maybe I did mention this one. Yeah, nftnl, I did, okay, good. So that brings us to the end of the lib in asterisk section. So the next one for the next episode is libqmi. That's the QMI library and utilities. It's a glib-based library for talking to modems. So I'm probably not going to have a whole lot to say about it, but we'll tackle it next time. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.